Wednesday edition, the seventh day of June 2006. Thank God nothing happened on 666 like so many thought it would. And no crazies went out there and went nuts, and the globalists didn't pull anything off because of their obsession with numerology. I am extremely honored to be joined for this full hour by Professor Stephen Jones. He has a doctorate in physics. He has published scores and scores of peer-reviewed papers that have been in some of the most prestigious scientific magazines and periodicals out there. And he has now gotten samples from pieces of the World Trade Center steel that have been sequestered in this country. They are certified. They have taken the samples. They've done scientific tests on them. He has done this with other scientists at his university, reviewing what he's done and overseeing the scientific test. And it is what I would call conclusive. And I want to walk through this with you today, that thermite, but not just thermite, the specific type of thermite patented for specific use in cutting steel columns. Then we look at the steel columns. You don't cut with thermite straight across. You cut at an angle so that the pillar doesn't settle on the area that wasn't melted through, so the pillars slide off. We see this. We see so many facets again, every time you keep researching, it just proves the next finding. And when that happens four or five times in a row, it gets scary. So joining us is Professor Stephen Jones. We're honored to have you, sir.
Thanks, Alex. Good to talk to you. It's good to see you last weekend.
You gave a great presentation. I was honored to introduce you.
Well, thank you very much, Alex.
You bet.
Your talk was absolutely fantastic. In fact, I was worried, now how am I going to follow this guy? I hadn't heard you speak before. You know, my talk is quite a different nature. I mean, in terms of, how can I compare myself to Alex Jones?
Well, I think you blew me away with the new information that you broke at that conference. And
we did have some new information. That's true.
Well, this is a short segment. We're going to break in a moment and come back in a long segment. And I'd like to just walk through how you woke up to 9/11, the research you've done, and the evidence of the thermite. First off, will you, just for the listeners that don't know who you are, give us your background, some of the publications you've written for, some of the research you've done?
Sure. Let's go back to graduate school. I was a graduate student in physics, got my PhD from Vanderbilt. Did most of my research, though, at the Stanford Linear Accelerator Center, and finished up my coursework at Stanford since I was out there doing the research. And then I did postdoctoral work at Cornell and Los Alamos National Lab. Well, you know, I've been around the block a few times. I have a publication in Scientific American with a dear friend of mine, Johann Rafalski. That was back in 1987, July. You want to look that up? The title of our article was Cold Nuclear Fusion. Yes, that's correct. We're talking there about muon catalyzed fusion. It was just a lot of fun. For a number of years, I was the principal investigator for the Department of Energy on this study of muon catalyzed fusion.
Amazing. So you've headed up investigations for the government before.
Yeah, yeah.
And now
Department of Energy funded our research. That's right.
And now
I proposed it. They funded it. Sure.
And now I think it's safe to say that you are heading up research for the 9/11 Truth Movement on the bizarre collapse of Tower 1, 2, and 7.
That's a fair statement. Working with others, of course, but yeah.
Professor, we're going to be right back after this quick 3-minute break. You get yourself a glass of water. We'll plunge right into the earth-shattering, earth-quaking research he's done that continues to be verified at every step. It is the hair on the back of my neck standing up. Professor Stephen Jones holds several degrees from prestigious universities. He is a doctor of physics. He's led investigations for the U.S. government, for different bodies, into different scientific developments and phenomenon. And he is uniquely placed and trained to investigate the controlled demolitions of Tower 1, 2, and, of course, Building 7. and I interviewed him over the weekend in Chicago. He gave one of the keynote addresses. I interviewed him in my hotel room for an upcoming film, and he came right out with it that 9/11 is an inside job. There's no other way to look at it. There's no other way to see it, because as you study it scientifically, by the rules of science, you would expect that somewhere you would start disproving the hypothesis, but it only strengthens it and opens out into whole other areas. And the official story is completely unscientific and a fraud and a lie. Professor Jones, let's just start off with the scientific method and some of the things we discussed in that interview, because, you know, you said as you investigated this, you expected to, you know, to not just always find the smoking gun, but you've been able to do that conclusively. So for those that don't understand the scientific method, can you kind of restate that for people and then get into why you first questioned it and then what you saw develop and now your thermite hypothesis being conclusively documented?
Sure. Well, in a nutshell, using the scientific method, we assemble all the facts that we can get our hands on, all the observations, photos, materials for analyses, everything we can find that would relate to the subject that we can possibly acquire. And then we try to find an explanation coming out of the facts and based on and consistent with all the facts, not just some small subset of the facts, you see. And that's the crucial difference between the scientific method, where we assemble facts and then develop an explanation. And frankly, what we saw as I look back to 9/11, I mean, as those buildings came down, people were already speculating and then very quickly stating, this is Al-Qaeda solely responsible, you know. And what facts can we find to support that foregone conclusion? You see, that's not science at all. So there's a big distinction there, incorporating all the facts as opposed to starting out with a conclusion and then just finding what facts you have to support your conclusion, which is called pathological science, by the way.
Yes, pathological science. You did the opposite. Once you started questioning, first off, why did you first question the collapse? And then once you began to do research, what did you notice? And then let's go right into the thermite.
Okay. Well, you know, I had several nudges along the way from friends, not scientists in this case, but friends who said, you know, you really ought to look into the 9/11 events and see what you think. There's a friend of mine, Steve is his name too, but he kept, you know, kicking me in the pants to look at it. I will say he finally showed me a certain DVD, but I found it unconvincing. I mean, that's too bad, because it kind of turned me off to the study, because it had so many speculations without evidence, you know. Is what we're talking about. As scientists like to start with the facts and then go from there. And this one was just filled with what I would call speculations without much supporting evidence. But I just kept receiving these nudges. Finally, I got on the web. I'll mention WTC7.net, because that's where I finally, you know, sat down and started looking hard. And the nice thing about Hoffman's site here and his coworkers is that they show evidence and then they provide references. So now I'm going and checking these references to make sure that these guys are telling the story straight and looking at the evidence myself. And when I saw Building 7 collapse, this is the first time I saw it, you know, that was the first part of 2005. I mean, that's how long it took me to finally get into the serious research here. When I saw the collapse of Building 7, man, I said to myself, that is strange. I'd never seen it before. You know, between 2001, collapse that afternoon, late afternoon, it was never hit by a jet, but here it comes straight down. I don't see any raging inferno in this building, but I do see it fall straight down. And pretty quick with students, you know, we measured the rate of fall. I teach Newtonian mechanics and was teaching it at that time. And so, anyway, we looked at the free fall compared to the fall of Building 7, and they're almost the same. 6.5 seconds is the time for the collapse of Building 7 compared with 6.0 seconds for an apple falling in a vacuum. Now we're talking about the corner of the Building 7. When that starts to move, we start our clock. And we did a fairly detailed analysis of it. So that's really how I got into it. And, you know, it took several nudges, and I assume that's true of other people, too. So as we give them these nudges, we're doing that right now on the radio.
Well, you don't want to believe it, but we have to, because we've got an out-of-control, dangerous group running our nation right now, and if we don't expose this, we're all in great peril. So you did a lot of research. You documented a lot of different facets. We have the underwriter. We have one of the chief engineers, Kevin Ryan, going public. They did internal models. They underwrote the building. He said it was impossible. Firefighter Engineering has said they covered up the crime scene. They're on record. So there's a lot of other prominent people as well. But but you discovered something in the government report. Then you found videos and photos of it, of this white-hot metal gushing out of the sides of the building. And you said, and of course, that goes back to the satellite and aircraft photos of multi-thousand degree fires weeks and weeks later burning when jet fuel only burns at 1,200 degrees. This is impossible. So go through that for us, and let's get into the thermite.
Yeah. So the metal pouring out of the South Tower from about the 80th floor, and this is just minutes before its collapse, enormous quantities of yellow-hot metal pouring out of the building. That was quite shocking to me to see those data. And that came out of this Scholars for 9/11 Truth group, you know, as we're trying to pull together whatever data we can. We would like to get all the videos from NIST. You know, they brag about having 300 hours of videos and thousands of photographs. Well, we would appreciate if they would release those data, you see. If there's nothing to hide, they shouldn't hide it. But anyway, we did come across this, and as I looked at that, I said, that is extremely interesting. And I mean, I'd heard about it, but it took a while for the group to trace down this video evidence. This is an amateur videographer, a couple of them actually, showing and capturing this event, this very anomalous activity, this molten metal flowing out of the building. As soon as I saw it, I knew it was not aluminum, because I had worked with molten aluminum before. And molten liquid aluminum has the property that it's silvery, rather like aluminum foil, you know, at all temperatures in daylight conditions. And so here's this yellow hot metal. I knew that couldn't be aluminum. Look, we did some checking the scholars group and the NIST report. It is in Appendix H. There's some discussion of this, and they say just simply it's probably aluminum, you know. Well, I knew that wasn't right.
Well, I would just also add, of course, aluminum melts at a lower temperature, but
another point. Yeah.
But still not at the 1,200 degrees. And when you look at the buildings, the fires are very low, almost burn out. Right before collapse, suddenly this yellow orangish lava basically starts pouring out of the sides. But you went further. You were able to actually get a hold of some of that. Oh, also, aluminum wouldn't stay at 2,500 degrees for several months. We have giant pools of molten metal down in the basement. So that's what first got you looking at this, right?
That's true, is the pools of molten metal. And photographed by Frank Selecchia out in New York, just a fantastic photo that he had in his possession that shows this claw pulling this yellow hot metal out of the rubble pile. I mean, to have it that hot days after the event, you know, weeks actually in this case.
Yeah, weeks and weeks after, you've got the big shovel in there, grabbing, and it just picks up a huge mass of white hot, ladies and gentlemen. Folks, for those that don't know, it is hard even with a conventional furnace to get steel white hot. And this stuff is white hot.
Yeah. At this stage, I would say it looks yellow, but earlier on, you know, thermites produces molten iron at white hot. So it's, yeah, it's...
Well, looking at the photo around the edges, Doctor, it's yellow, but I do see some white in that photo.
Okay. I'm looking at it, and I grant there's a little white there on the bottom. You know, this is the thing. There's so much evidence that, I mean, I've worked in other fields where the evidence is hard to come by. It's a little hard to come by here for some reason. But at the same time, when we do get the evidence, it just starts fitting together, pointing to the use of thermite. Thermite is what is capable of producing these white hot temperatures.
When we get back from this break, you have done the groundbreaking test. They were able to get samples. I don't know if we can tell the public this. I guarantee you the feds are listening to Jones to begin with. They know where they got it. But we'll see if he wants to talk about it. And they've done the test. They've had other scientists oversee the test. It is so conclusive, it's going to blow you away. Stay with us, Dr. Jones. Welcome back. Professor Stephen E. Jones, Doctor of Physics, joins us. You go to Infowars.com, right underneath his picture in today's guest section, you can link through to the detailed paper he has written. It's filled with video clips and photos and documents there for you to peruse his research. Professor Jones, please continue. Let's run through the samples. And by the way, I'm here in my studio right now in the other room editing the video interview we did with you, cutting out the questions. And we've gotten to the point during this very segment, and my editor said, do we leave this in or out, where they got the samples? So let me just ask you now, because I never had a chance to Sunday at the conference, do you want that left in or out?
Did I specify at which particular memorial park this was?
No, you didn't. No,
okay,
you didn't.
Let's leave it in.
Okay, guys, you heard it.
Because I don't want to put anybody, you know, in jeopardy. But because look, there's hundreds of these memorial parks. This is an interesting story, I think, Alex, and I'm glad you brought that up. See, when my paper came out last fall, October, November, there, I made comments that, you know, we're asking for people's help in gathering data. We're not getting much help out of NIST, frankly, and others. So we are asking people to help gather up data, and pretty quick, here's the story without revealing the precise location. It turns out that there are a number of places in this country, and I've learned other countries as well, where there are samples of the World Trade Center steel erected in a type of memorial, like a peace park or a memorial park for 9/11. Now, what's interesting is that then that means there's steel that can be looked at and observed. In this one case, the steel was sent to a place, and the welder who's putting it together, so he's making a monument out of this, you know, trying to make it stand up with these pieces of steel. And it was a volunteer, first of all, that went to Ground Zero, helped out there, and then was able to arrange for these steel members to be erected in his city as a memorial. And I thought that was great of him to do that. The welder's wife looked at the steel, and she noticed that clinging to the steel was a bunch of dirt and... I don't know if she noticed the molten metal, but she noticed this dirt and stuff clinging to the steel. Now it's going to be put outside, and she just had this thought, I'm going to take this material off the steel because it's going to be in the weather and it could easily be washed away and so on. She gathered it up and put it in a plastic container. When my paper came out, she sent me not all, but some of this material. It's quite a large quantity. In this material, there are samples of molten metal. Now that's one, and then I have another avenue too, but I don't know quite. This was a fellow working for 9/11 Truth that talked to people in New York was able to get another sample, you see. So we
now, to be specific, the feds took some of it away to warehouses. The lion's share was sent to China and South Korea under guard. No one was allowed to take photos or get near it. They acted very suspicious. But then, for propaganda uses, about a year later, they allowed some of the steel to be released, to be erected, never thinking that we would go test it. And so you see the video of this molten steel pouring out the exact signature you've seen before, and so you think, well, I need to get some to test it, and you said it looked like thermite. Thermite could create the heat we'd see to keep it hot for 4 or 5 weeks down in the ground after it collapsed. And sure enough, when you did the test, it wasn't just thermite. It was the exact derivatives, byproducts of the ignition that you would see with the specific type used for cutting. Why don't you tell us about it?
So I was rather surprised when we did the analysis. Now, as I emphasized to you when we talked, was that Monday, Alex, or Sunday? But anyway, this is still, the quantitative result is preliminary. I mean, we've determined that this is primarily iron, which is what you expect from the thermite reaction. It produces molten iron. What really surprised me, and I should have thought of this was the amount of sulfur. I mean, there's a fair clear signature for sulfur in the sample that we've been analyzing. And sulfur added to thermite, it's called thermate, call it by that technical name, thermate, and that is used specifically to cut through steel. I mean, when you put sulfur in thermite, whammo, that's like a hot knife through butter.
Stay there. We'll have plenty of time to get into this when we get back. This is so important, ladies and gentlemen. Professor Stephen E. Jones is our guest, Doctor of Physics. And clearly the buildings are brought down by controlled demolition. The firefighters, the police, the evidence, the underwriting laboratories, all of the evidence shows that. We know the official story is impossible, so we set about scientifically to come up with a hypothesis and then to test that. And every step of the way, we see evidence that that thermite was used. And specifically, Professor Jones just doesn't find evidence of thermite, the byproducts of thermite, that you wouldn't find unless it was thermite. They find the byproducts of thermate, which is the specific thermite mix with other compounds that accelerate it and cause it to burn even hotter, mainly sulfur. Break that down for us, sir.
Sure. You see, with sulfur added to thermite, what happens is that the heat of the thermite already heats up the steel, and then with the sulfur present, the sulfur is able to get into the steel, actually into cracks and intergranular spaces in the steel. And it lowers the melting temperature of the steel. Let me give you the numbers in Fahrenheit. Structural steel melts at about 2750 Fahrenheit. By the way, that's way above what the fires could heat the steel to in this WTC situation. Yeah, it's white hot. It's beyond white hot. And I don't know if you've ever had if you've ever had a wood burning stove, but you've never had that puppy melt on you, I dare say. So anyway, and you know, even if you put jet fuel in there, it's not going to melt. So anyway, let's come from melting at about 2750 Fahrenheit, and you bring that right down to, with sulfur added, see, now you can get the steel to melt at a lower temperature, around 1600 Fahrenheit. So, well, it's like putting salt on ice, and now the ice will melt. I mean, say it's 20 degrees outside, and you have this frozen ice on your sidewalk. Well, if you sprinkle salt on that, it'll melt it. See? And same thing happens with steel. When you add sulfur to it, it brings that melting temperature right down, and therefore it allows you to, with the hot molten iron from thermite, it just slices through the steel very rapidly in seconds. It's well known. I mean, I'm not revealing any secrets here. I just did a Google search during the break, Therm-8, which is sulfur primarily, is the main ingredient. Sulfur and potassium permanganate added to thermite, 893 hits. Thermite, I got 376,000 hits, of which Prison Planet was right up there on the top, by the way. So, yeah, I mean, this is not a state secret. In fact, you can buy this stuff, thermite, you can buy on eBay. I mean, I had recently a fellow saying, oh, don't talk about this. This is a mechanical engineer who's giving me some guff. But he's saying, oh, don't you dare talk about thermite. You know, you're telling the terrorists how to... I'm saying, you know, excuse me, thermite is extremely well known. I'm not trying to reveal any secrets here, but we're trying to find out what really happened and who the terrorists are, for heaven's sake.
Well, I would just ignore that idiot. Now, Professor, specifically, I want to go over what you found in the molten globulates that mm-hmm. were adhering to the side of these beams. Specifically, what were the byproducts, and what does that... Because, again, it wasn't just the byproduct. In your paper, you report the new addendum you've added with this new evidence. It wasn't just thermite. You had to then go, what is this? And you discovered it was specifically what you'd find with thermite.
Right. Yeah, and sulfur in abundance. And, again, I emphasize we'll have this quantitative analysis soon, but this takes time to be... quantitative on these analyses.
Peer-reviewed. In fact, without giving out names, privately you told us more for our report, but without giving out too many names until later, you worked with several other physicists, yeah. professors, and you specifically, right. one of your areas of study is going back and reconstructing things in archaeological
right.
Ways. So you are the specific discipline of of the whole field of physicists to look at this.
Right. This field is called archaeometry, in which I've taught courses in archaeometry at the graduate level, and that's, in essence, physics methods, advanced scientific methods applied to the study of archaeology. And so basically that's what we're doing here. We're trying to figure out what happened, just like archaeologists do, at a very interesting site. In this case, we're studying something that happened just... 4 or 5 years ago.
Well, that's who crime labs a lot of times in big murder cases
yeah.
hire is archaeologist or mm-hmm. Physicist in your persuasion, because they the crime labs aren't advanced enough in this study to be able to specifically get answers, but you guys are.
Right. Listen, I need to interject one thing occurred to me. In archaeology in general, and archaeometry in particular, we are very careful about the what's called the provenience of materials that we analyze. In this case, a lot of the evidence has been destroyed, as you mentioned. It's shipped off, literally melted in Asia for recycling. But I mentioned the importance of these peace parks and memorial parks around the world that have steel samples now. I want to clear that I don't want people to run out and start scraping these because we have to exercise some care. If people find a peace park, I'm very interested in more samples, but first please take photos. In fact, do that just as soon as you can so that, I don't know.
Document it like a crime scene. Take
right,
photos,
right.
get permission,
yeah.
Evidence it out, document
yeah.
in front of witnesses that you removed it properly, didn't contaminate
well,
it with other...
I wouldn't even remove it at this stage. In other words, just photograph it as quick as you can so that we, if somebody else, whoever that might be, comes along and scrapes off the globs of molten metal, that at least you've got pictures that it was there, but hopefully that wouldn't happen. So anyway, start with photographs, and if you could send those to me or, it's the Scholars for 9/11 Truth group. But anyway, if you send those to me, we can then think about and get the permissions to get the
byproducts of thermite, not
right.
just thermite, the specific type used and patented for cutting charges. And then we have the multiple photos and videos, and of course FEMA claimed, you know, don't shoot any video, don't take any photos, but people still did, of these huge columns sticking up, and they're not cut straight across, they're cut at angles. Why is that important? We see the molten, again, gray globules on the inside and outside of the beams. Why is that so important that, again, scientifically, we would expect, if it was done by design, it would be cut at an angle, and lo and behold, it is.
That's exactly right. Because if you cut it straight across, you know, horizontally, then, of course, the upper beam would just rest still on the lower beam. But by cutting it at about a 45-degree angle, then the support for the upper portion is gone. You've weakened the building every time you cut a column that way. I mean, in fact, the routine in demolitions is to pre-weaken the building before you set off explosives. And you go in and down low, you cut the columns in this fashion.
But they didn't have time on this, so along with the clear chemical explosives, and those were clearly in there, folks, they went ahead and jacketed columns with the thermite.
That's sure what it appears. I mean, the evidence is just building and building. Yeah. And you know, let me give credit to one of the guys, Robert, in the scholars group. He found a patent that goes back to the 1990s, which shows a cylinder. And in this cylinder, if you can imagine, it's got a groove along one edge, the long way. See? And you pack the cylinder with thermate or thermite, and then it's specifically stated to be used as a cutting device based on thermite. So you put your thermite in there, and then as you ignite that thermite, which can be done with a radio signal, then the molten iron shoots out through this groove in a line. I mean, that is an enormously effective way to cut through thick materials. And the patent specifically says this is designed to cut through thick materials. And of course, an example of that would be structural steel.
So right before the towers collapse, it's also key that this didn't happen right when the planes crashed. The fires have almost burned out. The people are standing in the wounds of the building. It's not even melting their flesh. But then just a few feet away from them, you will have basically white lava or yellow lava metal, molten steel, pouring out, and then you have the exact thermite reaction. We forgot that part, and you guys have done the laboratory test right there with other scientists overseeing you, so it can be peer-reviewed. You see that exact same type of thermite smoke coming off of it. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Yeah, I have to wait a minute. I've just had some students come by. Tell them to wait.
That's okay. We appreciate you giving us your lunch.
Yeah, so we're talking about the ash here. And, in fact, let me back up just a moment, Alex. We've done experiments now, I and some other professors here, with thermite. It's kind of fun to play with, to tell you the truth, but hazardous. And again, I have to emphasize, be careful with this stuff. Yeah, heck, you can buy it on eBay, so I'm afraid that the truth is out, about how fun this stuff is. And it's shown in chemistry classes all over the place.
Professor Jones, stop worrying. I think they've got like four or five shows on Discovery where the whole show is about thermite.
Okay. All right. So when you touch the stuff off, which isn't easy, by the way, it doesn't ignite easily. But when you do ignite it, then you get this white-hot molten metal. I mean, the reaction zone is just this brilliant white. We use dark glasses, sunglasses to protect our eyes then. And you have this white ash floating away as dust, a very fine powder of aluminum oxide floating away. That's one of the end products. And then, of course, the other end product that's so dramatic is this yellow to white hot molten iron that flows out of the reaction zone. Now, we actually added sulfur to some thermite, mixed it up here myself. And my daughter was helping me, by the way. She did it as a science fair project. She said, Dad, I want to. So I said, sure, we'll do that. We put some sulfur in, put it in a steel cup, and touched that off. And I'll tell you, she was going to time. How long does it take to eat through the steel? Well,
1 second.
It was a fraction of a second. I mean, it was so fast we couldn't time it.
Have you seen the Discovery Channel videos where they put it on a huge truck engine block, a little bitty cup of it, and it eats the entire block in like 2 seconds?
I've seen one just like that. In fact, I showed one in Chicago. Remember that?
Yes.
That's fun. People like to see how that got through. I don't think those guys added sulfur, though.
No.
You know? But see, if you add sulfur, it makes it go through steel considerably faster.
It basically explodes.
Well, Yeah, let me talk about explode. We call this an incendiary because there's no explosion sound. I mean, it's just a dramatic reaction, but it's over quickly, but there's no explosion sound.
But I would call the reaction explosive.
Okay.
I mean, so fast is...
It's very fast, but let me say there is a form of thermite that is actually explosive, just like TNT. I mean, it will explode. And that form is called super thermite. You can Google on that. Again, no secret. And this is ultra-fine aluminum powder mixed with ultra-fine iron oxide powder. I'm talking around 100 nanometers and down, particulate size. So when you do that, you touch that off, and it will explode. And frankly, the aluminum powder I got out of our chemical stores here was quite fine powder. And so the first time we ran it, we stood well back because I wasn't sure whether it was actually going to explode or not.
What do the other scientists that have been overseeing your research there at the university think?
Well, okay, let me say that those who have read my paper, by and large, support what I'm doing, certainly support the research. There are others who just, you know, shrug their shoulders and I don't know.
But you said
it's like
they're in denial,
else, Alex. You know, it's like anybody else. It's such a, the implications stop many people from going past square one. I mean, they say, well, wait a minute, you know, are we talking about an inside job here? And I'm saying, well, I'm talking about physics. And they say, but that would imply an inside job. I say, I'm afraid so. You know, explosives in a building, it takes time to plan and plant those explosives and incendiaries.
Oh, by the way, have you heard the newest? The neocons are now getting on talk radio and writing articles saying the Arabs put bombs and thermite in.
Oh, no, you're kidding.
No, no, sir. Yes, sir. They're now saying that the Arabs did it.
In Building 7, too, huh?
Yes. The,
I see. Now, this is
now it's no official announcement. The neocons are just out saying it.
That is interesting. Well, at least, you know, they're finding these arguments of thermite hard to refute, so an explosive. So I guess that's some degree of progress. But, of course, to suggest that Arabs had access in these buildings, particularly Building 7, which housed a secret CIA office, is ridiculous in the extreme.
Well, it was Defense Intelligence, the Port Authority, the city police. I mean, everybody was there.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, I mean, I know. This is a very secure building. I know. Yeah, I'm sure there's security. Who was it in charge of security at the towers? I mean, he would be offended to have the suggestion. Wasn't that a
Marvin Bush? Yes.
Oh, yes, Marvin Bush. I mean, he would be offended to hear that somehow these guys had slipped by them.
Well, there's other facets to this. I mean, in our talk, you talked about how we've had all these other skyscrapers burned for multiple days in some cases. These are laboratory experiments in the real world. That right there shows that the fires didn't bring these buildings down. Now you've got the thermite evidence. I mean, we got video of it pouring out. You've tested it. When you test it, it isn't just thermite, it's thermate. I mean, wow,
right.
this is amazing.
Yeah, it's one of those cases where the evidence as it comes out, and it takes some work to, you know, dig at it, literally dig at it in the case of the molten metal samples. It just fits this picture of controlled demolition. And the case is getting overwhelming now, I'm afraid.
Well, I salute you, Professor Stephen Jones. A final little five-minute segment here on the other side. You get back to your students and maybe have time to eat that bologna sandwich you've got. I'm guessing what you're eating for lunch.
It was tuna, but yeah, you're right. I was eating.
I'm the same way. We'll be right back. Professor Jones did a great job at the Chicago 9/11 conference. He'll be doing his big PowerPoint complete with video clips, documents, photos, going over the collapse of World Trade Center 1, 2, and 7. Coming up on the 24th and 25th. He's one of our keynote speakers. We really look forward to him being there and thank him for being there. Get your tickets now at Infowars.com. They're going quick. It's going to sell out. You're going to wish. It happens every event I ever have. We'll turn away hundreds. In fact, they had standing room only in Chicago, and this wasn't my event. It was supposed to hold 500. It was really over 600. They overfilled it. People were standing. I don't want to do this with my event, so we're going to cut it off And it's going to sell out. So call toll free to get tickets, 1-888-253-3139. Or go to InfoWars.com and find out all the details. Professor Jones, in the last 3 minutes we've got left here, I want to thank you for joining us, but any other facets, any other areas, any other key points you'd like to make here today?
Well, we've covered that which is most interesting to me. I guess I will, well, first of all, I'm looking forward to the L.A. conference. That was great fun in Chicago, and I think what you're doing in L.A. will be, as you say, bigger, and I'm really looking forward to that.
What about going back to your previous research? I mean, before you were just showing mathematically and with science that the official story was impossible,
and
how they claim they fell was a lie. Now you've got this, and then we've got all the firefighters and police saying bombs are going off, and we have all this other. We have Silverstein slipping up and saying he pulled it. I mean, is this not an orgy of evidence? Did they think that we wouldn't notice or we wouldn't catch him? Why do you think they thought they'd get away with it?
Oh, gosh. I mean, now we're out of physics into pathological psychology, Alex. I mean, these guys, but, you know, they made mistakes, I think, is the explanation. And, I mean, they shipped this steel out. They figured they, in my opinion, this was terrible. I mean, and many others, too, to ship that evidence out of there and melt it. But they made mistakes. I mean, there's enough evidence around that we can piece together. Is the archaeology or archaeometry. We can actually piece together fairly clearly now what's happened. And
you specifically spoke, I mean, you said two colleagues work with you on these projects there. What are they now saying after these other scientists worked with you?
Well, in particular, one of them working with me, his approach is, it has been for months. He says, I am determined to find out what's in these previously molten metal samples and publish it and let the chips fall where they may. That's his approach. He said, I don't really like to get into who was involved. Now, personally, I find I have to try to figure that out too, but it's hard. And you've done a lot of research on that, and I like Webster Tarpley's research and others. You know, people have gotten into it, but
you were trying to say something before I interrupted you. What was that?
Oh gosh, I guess that the people I'm working with here are becoming convinced. I talked to Jeff yesterday, and you know, another physicist, and he said he's been reading about, you know, the neoconservatives and the bankers, and you know, it doesn't take long. You get into this, and again, the evidence starts falling into place. I mean,
well, the big thing is these globalists brag about it. They write policy. They write policy papers, and then you've got their own words.
Yeah, you got that PNAC document, which I read through, and I mean, it's couched in language. It doesn't sound too bad, but then you read about this catastrophic and catalyzing event, and you're sitting there, boy, I hope they don't have another one of these up their sleeve, you know. And so, well, that possibility does raise some urgency and means that this scientific research is more than just an academic exercise.
It's about saving this country. Professor Jones, thank you for what you're doing. I can't wait to shake your hand again and buy you dinner in Los Angeles. We'll see you on the...
look forward to it.
You bet. Get back to your class. God bless you.
Okay. Thanks, Alex. Talk to you later.
Bye-bye. Take care. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we got a special interview coming up for you, and I'm off to Bilderberg. Bye-bye.